Hi, welcome back to Draft Veterinary Podcast. My name is Dr. Alfred Tan, and today I think I have to say I have the specialist guest I've ever had so far, based on obligation. We have Dr. Pamela Coloretta here. Do you want to say hello? Hi. So she is obviously a veterinarian. We've known each other for a little while now.
Yeah.
Some would say she's my girlfriend.
Just sometimes.
Well, I mentioned before that I moved here to Florida for reasons, and this is kind of obviously one of the reasons. So you graduated vet school with me. We're both Caribbean students. But why don't you kind of go from there, after kind of life after the island?
Yeah.
And where you've been?
Well, I mean, I graduated a year after you.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Ohio to do my clinical year at Ohio State University.
Uh-huh.
Go Bucks. And that was a really fun year, I think. That was one of my favorite years of vet school. And the staff there is phenomenal. The students are phenomenal. I recommend Ohio State to everyone. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I started an internship, which is where I'm at now.
Mm-hmm.
An internship. It's a rotating internship. So I go through different specialties at 2 weeks at a time, similar to clinics,
uh-huh.
except I'm a doctor now. And then I do a lot of emergency overnights kind of thing.
You rotate through different departments and mm-hmm. figure out, yep, okay. And I think most of us, I think most of the listeners who are veterinarians kind of have an idea of what the internship is like. I think what makes you stand out a lot compared to, you know, the general public is what you're pursuing.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And so mm-hmm. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
You did just recently land in a residency. What residency?
Veterinary behavior, which is psychiatry for animals. So mental health is part of our overall health, I believe. And animals suffer from fear, anxiety, stress every single day. We deal with aggressive animals, separation mm-hmm. anxiety, you know, the basics.
Yeah.
And the most common reason for why animals get rehomed.
I think actually one of the ways I met you when we first started seeing each other on the island was you did have some workshops on the field, kind of helping out with socialization and, or I guess exposure is
yeah.
the better term between adult dogs, which is really cool.
Yeah, they were like training classes, just basic obedience. But I did have some reactive dogs there uh-huh. too, so they would bark on leash. So I would help give the owners and the dogs tools to be able to have more enjoyable walks.
So you've had quite a bit of experience with this specialty before, which is kind of unique because, you know, I have a lot of friends who try to, and I guess I'm a lot of friends, but I have specialty friends who are currently doing residencies in surgery or emergency medicine or critical care or even in internal medicine. And I mean, they never really got to practice this before vet school, right? They kind of really dove in once they entered this, but I believe you have some pretty extensive specific behavior experience before.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, there are nurses like that work in the surgical, like with yeah. surgeons and stuff, but I think you're right. The majority of their experience is like with anesthesia or mm-hmm. maybe assisting, which is also a great experience. But yeah, I was a veterinary assistant for Florida Veterinary Behavior Service with Dr. Lisa Radasta before vet school. And as a vet assistant, I was in every appointment with her. So I was typing up her discharges and listening to how she ran the appointments and how she came about her diagnosis. And she knew I had an interest in behavior. So she's always been a great mentor who's answered any and all questions I might have, you know?
That's really cool. And she's an extremely, extremely well-known member
yeah.
of the Behavior Society, Veterinary Behavior Society. I believe she did come up with a book, which I listened to.
With Dr. Marty Becker, yeah.
With Dr. Marty Becker. And can you want to kind of name drop that title for people listening?
Yeah, it's From Fearful to Fear-Free. And it's good for owners and veterinarians too. She's part of the whole Fear-Free. I think she's on the board.
Okay.
She's on the board, mm-hmm. I believe, but I might be wrong. But like, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. I was a big Audible fan. And so that's on audio book available for you to listen to. Mm-hmm. And I'd have to say, yeah, it's really good for veterinarians and owners. It's very friendly for both sides of that. And it gives you really, really good insight on kind of the just touching up on animal behavior, which is obviously something you'll be doing for the next few years,
mm-hmm.
which is great.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Yeah, what exactly kind of, you know, what about this kind of drew you in? Was it something that you realized was identified as part of your strengths, or was it something that once entering this, you kind of stumbled upon Dr. Rodasta working for her, and then this kind of grew into something you became very passionate about.
Well, I think it started with the fact that I got a fearful puppy. So Hank is terrified of the world, as you know. So it started there, and I kind of started reading about positive reinforcement and how to help fearful dogs and all of that. And then when I moved from Tallahassee here, because I went to Florida State for undergrad, that's when I learned about Dr. Lisa Rodasta, and I was like, hey, can I shadow you? Because I had a I had a strong interest in that. And then that's when she actually ended up offering me a job. And there's just a need for it, you know? I challenge you to name a specialty that isn't affected by behavior.
Yeah.
No matter what specialty or GP you're a part of, you're going to have a fearful, anxious, aggressive dog in your specialty, and you need to be able to manage that. Surgeons need to manage that for recovery. Oncology needs to manage that because your patients are coming back every week for treatments, you know? And the list goes on and on. Same with medicine. What about, you know, those patients that you can't get insulin into because they start becoming aggressive? Like, behavior touches every specialty. And I think there's a huge need for it in the world. There's not that many veterinary behaviorists out there. And it's not taught at every school.
I think there's only, was it like less than 80 boarded veterinary behaverists in the world or something? I don't know.
I haven't looked up the numbers lately, but it's
a handful.
It's a handful. Compared,
okay.
Yeah. Compared to other specialties, it's a handful. And it's just something that is not taught at every vet school. And it's something that unfortunately not everybody believes in despite science.
Yeah.
So there are multiple peer-reviewed articles out there on the best way to deal with fearful and anxious dogs. There are consensus statements out there, but we still have, unfortunately, even some veterinarians that use positive punishment. So, you know, your choke collars, prong collars, shock collars, and believe in the dominance theory, which has since been debunked.
The war going on between veterinary behaviorists and people who follow Caesar Milan. And those
and it's not just people, unfortunately. So, So there's a there's a need for us, and I think that it hugely impacts the quality of life of animals. So I saw it as a specialty where I could make a huge impact on the life of my patients.
Absolutely. And now, so,
and their owners, honestly. Yeah.
I mean, I come from primarily hospitals that don't practice a fear-free and have a behaviorist who's on board to kind of walk them through this. So the Ohio State had that. Colorado didn't, even though I'm very biased on Colorado. But what are some, how do you think the impact of a board of veterinary behaviorist in academic setting can kind of shape this? Obviously, you don't have anything to compare to, but how was that experience for you?
In
your clinical year.
It was huge, you know, so coming to, like, talking about just community practice, which is just GP, essentially. All of our exam rooms had treats stocked and ready to go. You had pretzel rods, you had canned food, you had baby food, you had Braunschweiger, which is liverwurst. Like, you had a ladder of treats for the patients. You had non-skid mats ready on the tables, which is a huge thing, even though we might not think of. And they could be put on the floor for your big arthritic dogs. We didn't take rectal temperatures. We took axillary, which honestly, if it's a healthy dog, right, that's coming in for vaccines, otherwise doing well at home, do you need to do a rectal temperature? And if it's a worked up dog, chances are that rectal temperature is going to be elevated because that dog is fired up, you know? So they did that. And then one of the big things about fear-free is that you don't sit there and struggle with the patients. So as soon as we saw that they couldn't do it, they weren't handling it, we were like, okay, this isn't working. And they explained it to the owners and they said, here are some meds, come back with these meds on board. And then they would go to sedation, right? We didn't waste time trying to make it work while the pet struggled.
Putting them in a chokehold, getting them in a towel burrito and all that kind of. Okay.
No, it was, we tried, it didn't work. They were too stressed. Okay, meds. It was kind of, it made a huge difference just in community practice. But you had that also in all of the other services. Sometimes to lesser degrees, sometimes not. But I mean, everybody had the mats, everybody had the cheese.
Yeah.
And having a veterinary behaviorist there had people, had the other specialties reach out for help, which is really nice.
How was the tone? Was it, I mean, because I'm guessing it wasn't completely just focused around veterinary. It wasn't the primary, but the fact that it had an influence throughout all of the practice really kind of, I guess the question is, was it very tense? Were they kind of feeling, well, there's a veterinary behaviorist kind of creeping out our back here. Should we be careful?
Or, okay. Not at all. It wasn't tense. I mean,
that's cool.
Dr. Heron was there when I was there, and they had, they all had a fantastic relationship as far as I'm concerned. Of course, there's always going to be people that aren't drinking from the Kool-Aid until they see it work, you know? So there were some people who didn't necessarily buy into it, which is, I mean, it is what it is.
It is the reality. Yeah. You're always going to have people who are against it.
But it wasn't tense. Mm-mm.
Now, kind of going into overall image, I mean, obviously in academic settings where we have cutting edge research, cutting edge veterinarians easily influence, you know, fourth, second, third, first years, right? It's a little bit easier to kind of influence them into going towards animal behavior, or at least practice towards fear-free. But I think with old school veterinarians, with kind of the overall general consensus, there's still some pushback.
Oh, yeah. There's still pushback, even in the sense of like them not thinking that we're real doctors.
So
there's still that pushback. And I know some people still get those comments like, oh, why are you wearing a stethoscope? Or maybe you should wear a stethoscope so you look like more like a real doctor. You know, I mean, the pushback is there, even questioning the fact that we're actually veterinarians, which, I mean, we did the 4 years, we took the NAVLE, we did an internship and a residency. And it's the same length residency. It's 3 years. You still have to take boards after the fact. So you still have to publish research. It's the same thing.
I ask this because I'm curious to know, you know, everyone has their own strategies of fighting this level of adversity, especially when someone kind of looks down on you, right? Mm-hmm. Do you push back with, you know, do you bite back? Or is this something where you feel your specialty, your expertise, your intelligence and the value of your residency or your knowledge is eventually going to show itself? And I mean, I guess it kind of has in a way, just based on how things have kind of progressed in the last, I would say, decade or two, has it?
You can't bite back. You have to be, there has to be kind of, I guess, some strategy to the approach, right? Of course, if I see someone holding an animal in a way that I'm like, this could be done more efficiently, I want to say something, but it also depends on the situation and it's all about how you approach it, right? So certain things I will come up and be like, hey, can I show you this? Can I show you a different way to do this? But other things, sometimes you have to let go. You have to pick your battles.
Yeah. I guess it's the same for all veterinarians, right? I can't force every person to get a TPLO or some kind of surgery for a dog that has a CCL rupture, right?
But there's not a question whether a TPLO is a necessary treatment.
Yes, that's true.
So there is that. And you can only plant the seed and just give them the information that you have and your resources. And the seed's been planted. If they don't want to listen to you in that moment, then that's fine. But you hope that down the line, usually when they see that it works, then they're like, oh.
So you lead by example in this kind of instance.
Yeah. Then.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
For sure.
Great. For people who don't know much about veterinary behaviorists, what pathways can you go? Obviously, you know, you can have an influence in academia and you can work for a university. How would a typical private practice behaviorist kind of function and operate on a regular day?
I think that's a hard question because I only have experience with one.
Okay.
And everybody runs their practices differently. You know, I'm sure some veterinary behaviorists in different states do more home visits.
Okay.
Than they do clinic visits.
So there's several different forms.
Yeah, okay, there's really no standardized way. Okay. It's not like ophthalmology or cardiology or it's not that well established where you have so many private practices that you can look at and be like, oh, this is the standard way. At least not as far as I know yet. But the way I can tell you, appointments are long. There's a lot of talking. There's a long questionnaire you fill out beforehand, usually in my experience, because we want as much information prior to the fact as well. And then while we're talking to you, we delve into more detail. So visits can range anywhere from 1 hour to 3 hours, depending on academia, they're longer. The private practice I used to work at, they're an hour to an hour and a half. And then they have treatment appointments too with the techs.
All right. Treatment appointments. And what does that mean?
That's like behavior modification. So that is more changing how the animal feels, which will in turn change, can change their behavior. Their behavior, like their aggression, is just a clinical sign of their disease, essentially, right? Because it is a disease. So, it's pathologic.
Okay. And from obviously dating you the last few years, I've learned that there is a huge variety of different medication I've never even heard of.
Yeah. We have kind of two classes, the anxiolytics and the antidepressants. The anxiolytics are more fast-acting, I would say. So you've got like clonidine, gabapentin, trazodone, some of which we're pretty familiar with. And then, they're the same ones. A lot of the time, sometimes we'll mention, oh, we're going to place your dog on Prozac or Xanax or whatever it may be. And the owners are like, oh, I'm on that, So they're on the same drugs. They're people drugs. Some of them are FDA approved for use in animals. Others we use off-label, but they're safe, pretty well tolerated.
That's pretty great.
And they do wonders.
So one question I have of many is, what is the biggest misconceptions of veterinary behavior? Not so much of what they assume with your specialty, but what people think is actually the appropriate thing to do to kind of train their dog or manage their dog's behavior, but really is pretty destructive for them in the long run.
I can say, okay, so something that isn't great, that could be destructive to their dog's emotional well-being, would be shock collars for sure. And I've definitely seen some cases when I was an assistant where the dog became aggressive secondary to the shock collar. Mm. There's also another,
those prong collars.
Prong is collars, example. Yeah. Okay. But I think a really common misconception that we hear is when we tell them, you have to use food to change how they feel. Owners sometimes say, well, aren't we then inherently rewarding the growling or the biting or whatever?
Yes.
And you're not, because it's an emotional response, right? If you've got a scared baby that's crying and you pick it up to comfort it, you're not rewarding that behavior. Mm-hmm. You're making them feel better. So the food really is just kind of to snap them out of it and bring something positive into it and a distraction initially. But it's also a way to change how they feel, because again, that aggression that you're seeing is just a symptom. The underlying cause is the fear, the anxiety, the stress, and that's what we have to target to change the aggression.
Okay. Yeah, no, I came across a nurse who was, lady was barking actually at work, and I started giving her treats, and the nurse was like, you're going to just make the dog bark even more. Like, contrary, actually. And so this was a nurse who's been working for decades.
Yeah.
Longer than I've been alive. And so, it's very, very interesting.
Well, yeah. I mean, for a really long time, Cesar Millan and his training methods was what was believed to be right. So now we know better, but sometimes it takes a little bit for it to catch on.
And that's the beauty of medicine, right? I say this all the time. It's the beauty of medicine and how things are going to constantly be changing for the most part, or sometimes just get updated as we learn more about better methods or more effective methods.
Yeah,
for sure. All right. So now you're 6 months into your, almost even 7 months into your internship.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So obviously I know, I have a personal idea of how things have been, but for those who are either, in vet school and thinking about doing an internship, what are your thoughts?
I strongly recommend an internship. I know you know this, and we've talked about this a lot. I think the learning that you gain from it is invaluable. I mean, I understand that it's a year of not great pay, but the amount that you get out of it, I think, is just worth it, in the long run. And I think the amount of cases I've had to manage, just like the last three overnights I had were rough and I had a lot of critical patients, but those last three overnights, I learned a lot.
Yep. And that's lady crying. No, I have to agree. I mean, I've witnessed over the last six or 7 months kind of your evolution as a veterinarian. I mean, you went from just becoming a veterinarian to now, 6 or 7 months later, to kind of the level of confidence and expertise that you have it's already greater than some GPs who've been out for longer than you have,
And thank you.
Yeah. Including myself, after I was out for 6, 7 months, no, I definitely didn't have the level of knowledge. And we'd obviously have some level of disagreement on how we feel about internships. I still personally feel like, just with the level of loans that we have, the financial struggle, sometimes it might be difficult to really sacrifice that year. But you're absolutely right. The level of knowledge, again, this is going to be a long conversation to have if we were to open the floodgates to this argument. But either way, there's no wrong answer, I don't think. Ultimately, it's about mentorship. It's about your education.
It is. And I think that's why I personally think that even if you're not thinking about specializing, you should do an internship. And I think it's because the chances of you getting really good mentorship and really moving forward in your veterinary career and feeling more confident and comfortable as a doctor, you've got a better chance of that in an internship because they are designed for that.
I agree.
Whereas if you go into GP, you could get really lucky and get a really good mentor for sure. I'm not saying that's not out there, but I think you could.
Your chances are way higher with a mentor, with an internship. Absolutely.
Yeah. So much. Yeah. And it's just beneficial. And you have a higher
specialists.
You've got a higher caseload because you're also seeing emergency and you're learning to manage these really critical patients. And not only that, but you're also learning from the GPs that transferred over, right? You see what they've done, how they've started, and then where to go from there.
And obviously it comes down to, you know, the listeners on this podcast, it comes down to what you want, right?
Yeah.
Now, we obviously value the idea of improving your education and, you know, fine-tuning whatever skills you can. We've talked about, you know, when we're 50 and 60, we don't want to just kind of settle in. We still want to be updated on our medicine and still have quality modern medicine. Mm-hmm. There are vets out there who kind of are okay with settling with just kind of less. If they're okay with just seeing, you know, vaccines, those kinds of things. I apologize for the dogs. You know, they're usually okay with that. And that's kind of to each his own, obviously, right? And fortunately, you know, those vets who do kind of accept that role, they don't go ahead and, you know, bite more than they can chew. They'll typically refer out and they'll kind of, you know, and obviously there's going to be emergencies who get frustrated with that. But, you know, at least they know within their own personal limits and they don't push it. So, I mean, you know, again, to each his own.
Yeah.
So over the last 6-7 months, obviously, you know, you had really good learning experience, but what are some bad things? Loaded question.
Yeah. I guess with any internship, you've got long hours and you're tired all the freaking time. So there's that. I've been pretty lucky with my internship in that it's pretty nice. Like we're only on call, we're on surgery. We do have rounds every morning. We do have to come in early to soap our patients. But unless you're on the surgery service, you don't really have to come in on the weekends to take care of patients. Usually they get transferred to emergency. So really the long hours, but I guess that comes with the territory. Mm-hmm.
I think also there is a difference between, you know, every single internship practice, right? I mean, there's, and I think that for those who are listening who don't know much about internships, and if they're curious to learn more, talk to your mentor at your vet school. Or another person who's either gone through the internship program to get some more information. But obviously there is the academia route, which I think people choose to go to those schools because obviously connections and it tends to have a higher chance of matching you to
your residency.
A more competitive, well-known residency.
Yeah, for sure.
It
gives you, a connection too, you know? So if you're an internship at a certain school, maybe you can be a resident there too. Depending on the school.
Or their school faculty know other school faculties and write you a good letter of rec based on that.
Good connections, for sure. Mm-hmm. And then just as with going out of practice, like going out into practice and potentially getting good mentorship or not, you run that risk with private internships too. But I think as long as you do your research, you'll be okay. And same with matching from a private internship. I think you can get a pretty good residency. It's just luck of the draw.
And also what you make of it, right?
Yeah, it's definitely what you make of it. Attitude is everything.
Same with vet school, right?
Yeah,
as Caribbean vet students, right? We were given pretty good playing cards. It's just kind of how we wanted to play with it, right? Now, obviously for behavior residency, it's not going to be as straightforward as what you might expect from others, right?
Right. Behavior residencies, traditional ones through the match, are less overall. And from what I know, they don't always accept like every year, right? So that depends. And then there are a lot more of non-traditional residencies, which are outside of the match, which are still just as good. They're just not through universities. And part of that is due to the fact that there's not that many veterinary behaviorists at universities. So it is a little bit non-traditional and there's a little bit more work that you have to put into that, I think. But if you want to do it, it's worth it.
Okay. Do you want to talk at all about your kind of goals of veterinary behaviorist when you become boarded and what your kind of long-term goal is, but what other options can behaviors do? I know that with Dr. Lisa Rodasta, she also has a pretty important job of communicating her research to the rest of the world, essentially. And she goes on.
She does a lot of lectures. She is part of Fear Free, like I said. I mean, she travels all the time and speaks all the time. And that is something, I mean, I would love to follow in her footsteps. I think she's fantastic. she's my mentor and she's phenomenal, you know? So brilliant. I would like to follow in those footsteps, but I want to practice. I want to do everything. I don't know how feasible it'll be. I want to practice. I want to see patients. I want to speak, you know, I want to lecture, travel. I think that would be fantastic. And then I also want to teach vet students because I think that's where it all starts. Like the students at Ohio State would say, you know, I don't know why people don't do this. It's common sense, referring to cheese or whatever during physical exams. And I'm just like, it's common sense to you because you had the class to,
the foundation,
you
know, you had the foundation built on it. Yeah.
But it's not common sense for people who don't get that exposure in vet school. So I would like to mold young minds, yes, too.
The impressionable minds.
Yeah.
Okay. So that does kind of transition a little bit into kind of our relationship, mm-hmm, and kind of our goal. Obviously, you know, we're currently in South Florida for the next few years.
Yeah.
But we'll see where things take us, because I think it'd be really cool to be under a university and kind of help shape those young minds into,
yeah, for sure,
more of a behavior mindset, or at least have a foundation of it.
That would be really cool. And then I guess, I mean, that's kind of it, right? And then starting a family and all of that, and just, mm-hmm, managing that, yeah, with our goals, because you have goals and I have goals, and we need to.
I got a couple.
Yeah. Just a few.
The, you know, listeners here on the podcast who are students or who are dating other people from their class or kind of in the same field, we'll kind of go over a couple minutes of just how our relationships kind of, how it is and how it's kind of shaped and revolved around veterinary medicine. Because it is.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think at some points it was a little rough initially, I think, with me starting clinics and you starting practice. It was just touchy with how we would approach each other with certain things. If we would disagree, things could feel personal. I think we've gotten pretty good about that, though. Like, we've talked about cases, and I would be more from like the university standpoint, and
you more
more private practice. So I think that was rough at first, but we figured it out.
I mean, obviously, communication's super important.
Yeah.
Getting to know each other's boundaries, what ticks us off, is also the fact that we have an understanding of medicine. It's, mm-hmm, we know exactly, a little more fine tuning of how to communicate that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Well, you know, we I know there's a lot of people in vet school who kind of meet and they date, and I would say a good chunk of them probably end up staying together,
yeah,
right? You know, we kind of look at our colleagues, and there's a couple there. We kind of share the student debt, so that's going to be a big one that we've talked about pretty extensively, and that's going to definitely be something that people who are currently dating in vet school who are listening in, just be aware of that, because that's going to be something that you're going to have to tackle together.
Then there's also the fact that we understand the long hours and how tired we are, and the fact that, like, sometimes I don't want to talk when I get home because I've talked all day, and that's okay. And same with you, right? So we can understand and share that. And also what I was going to say earlier was just understand the fact that sometimes when we share complicated cases or tough cases, we're not always looking for input,
yes,
on what we would have done. We're just looking to express that it was a rough case. So yeah, there's that.
That's definitely it. Giving each other boundaries,
yeah,
of our own independent medicine,
yeah,
practice
for sure,
of medicine, for sure.
And I think that'll be a lot easier once I'm more in like the behavior side.
Yeah. Yeah. Potentially.
And potentially.
And also just with my big learning curve over the last few, mm-hmm, months since I've entered, you know, more of a specialty practice and stuff, it's been definitely, yeah, much more insightful for me too. So it's been good.
Yeah. We've both done a lot of learning.
Yeah. But we did long distance for 2 years,
yes,
for a couple of years. And then now we're finally in the same state. Now we're still we're not doing long distance anymore, but we're still in different counties.
Short distance.
But, you know, with obviously the current pandemic, it's been difficult to spend time to be around each other. But otherwise, you know, I think it's the fact that, yeah, I have to say it's been nice to kind of have someone who's in the same field.
Yeah, I agree. Right? Someone that I can talk to and just express like, oh, today sucked and this is why it sucked. And like, you can understand exactly why it sucks.
Yeah. And it's nice on my end because both of our pets have some weird quirks mentally and obviously have a good idea of how to manage that and kind of get them to connect better.
Yeah. And then That also poses a challenge down the road, I think, with us living together, since our dogs are both dog reactive, and my dog is really just...
He's a special guy. He's the one you guys could probably heard on the in the background. And Lady's just a bit of a crybaby. But yeah, I mean, we'll definitely give updates, kind of, if people are interested in listening, kind of how it is with veterinarians as a relationship and kind of, you know, going through a residency and all that stuff together.
That starts in November.
Congratulations again,
babe. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So we are big fans of Eliza Schlesinger, right? Sorry, I don't know why I pronounced that wrong. Eliza Schlesinger. And so she has a podcast called Ask Eliza Anything, which I highly recommend people listen to. I stole a segment from hers called Top of the Cob, and I call it Oma Sarcoma. So Pam, Dr. Colorado, you're familiar with kind of how that plays out. Do you happen to have an Oma or Sarcoma?
I do. It's Justin's peanut butter.
Okay.
It's my absolutely favorite peanut butter. I think it's delicious. It's got just the right amount of crunchies. It's not too sweet.
Crunchies.
I know. Oh, it's so good. And I haven't been able to find it in Publix. Every time I've gone, I've only seen the almond butter, which I'm not as much of a big fan of.
Yeah, it comes off a little. I think almond butter needs to have a little extra either like sugar on it to just to kind of, it has a bit of a dry, coarse texture. So if you add anything, it makes a difference. But yeah, I remember Justin's, I think it came out when we were like in college, maybe like a decade ago.
I don't remember.
And it was just almond butter is what I knew. It was like, you know, an $8 almond butter. And it was kind of like, ooh, fancy. And that's kind of the last thing I remember about Justin's.
Mm-hmm. Love the peanut butter. It's just, it's perfect.
Yeah, well, you hear you bought like two cans or two containers.
And I one think for you, already, one for me.
And you're already almost finished with one of them, so.
Joey doesn't share food.
Joey doesn't share food. So my Oma is, I recently bought a hammock. And it's kind of been life-changing because I've been wanting one for a while. And it seems kind of like, you know, when you think of a hammock, especially as someone who's not raised or born in like a Caribbean-ish environment like Florida, it's almost kind of tacky. Because you think of it as like, oh, well, you're trying to mimic some Caribbean lifestyle of some sort. A lot of the times also weird because most hammocks, you have to like tie it to a tree and it's really awkward. But I came across this thing where it has like a metal stand, which is pretty sturdy. And so I decided to buy it and put it on my balcony. And it's been great. I wake up in the morning and I just relax on the hammock for like an hour or so, just chilling out, soaking up some sun. And it is an absolute game changer. I highly recommend it if anyone wants to invest in it. I think it was like $50 or $60.
Yeah, I agree. It's a really nice hammock.
Yeah. All right. What is your sarcoma?
My sarcoma is people not believing COVID is real, people protesting COVID. I think that is really getting under my skin lately.
Yeah. My last podcast with Phil, we definitely talked about COVID as well.
Yeah.
COVID-19. And just, I mean, it totally makes sense that this is going to be kind of a concurrent theme of sarcomas.
It is.
Because it's a total sarcoma in so many people's lives right now.
I have no words because it just doesn't make sense to me. You know, you have people out there who signed up to save lives, risking their lives every day. They didn't sign up to risk their lives every day fighting virus with inappropriate PPE. You know, like that's not something they signed up for. They signed up to save lives. And here they are getting sick. Some doctors and nurses are dying over this because they don't have adequate PPE. And then you've got people saying, oh, this is fake and protesting it, which is also absurd to me because it's, what are you protesting?
Yeah.
You know, so that really has been getting under my skin. And I think those protests are a huge slap in the face to all the healthcare professionals that are out there risking their
hundreds
lives
of hours a week just dedicated
and using the same N95 masks for days at a time because we can't get them, you know? So that's my sarcoma.
No, it's been a pain. I think people are starting to go crazy in their house, right?
Yeah.
And they're like, well, no, those were kind of question the efficacy or the legitimacy of this whole pandemic. And now they're like, well, I mean, I don't see myself or people that I know getting sick. This is not as bad as the flu. And now people are coming out and protesting, which is crazy because I think the biggest thing, and I guess this, I'll kind of piggyback on the sarcoma because they have this whole thing of, well, I have my rights, I have my freedom.
But you still have that.
And no one's really taking away their freedom.
No one's taking away your freedom. You can still go out for a walk. You can still go buy groceries.
You're not incarcerated.
Right. You can still go for car rides.
Yeah.
Sure, you can't go to parks, but you can't go to parks because if you can go to parks, that means everyone can go to parks, which means it defeats the purpose of the self-quarantine. But you can go out for walks around the block. Like, you can't go get your nails done, which, by the way, sucks. So I feel you. I get shit on that. Yeah, you know, and you can't go get your hair cut, but you can't go to a ball game. That sucks. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you still have your basic freedoms. You still have the ability to go out and live your life, just not do the like non-essential fun things, which sucks, but like get creative, play some board games, spend time with your family, like let this pass. Let us get to a point where we maybe have a treatment for this, and then we can slowly integrate back.
Yeah.
Until we get a vaccine, but you know.
I'm with you on that. And you know, I don't want to downplay the emotions of the people who are protesting, right? I understand that. I don't agree with it, but I think it's important that we also note people who are protesting is because now they're in a situation where they are not making any income because they're not, quote, essential.
But they're not protesting that.
Well, but
they're protesting because they think it's fake.
Yes, but I think it's a multifactorial thing. People who jump on this bandwagon of being against this whole quarantine, there's a whole stressful fact about the economy and how that's affecting. So there's a lot of people who are really, really essentially screwed based on this because, for one, they're not, you know, I think I sent you a video about this man in New York who went on a 4-minute rant. It was an incredible rant about how, like, okay, here you are. You're out of work for 3 months, but we're giving you 1 month of a stimulus check.
Oh, for sure.
But you still have to pay your mortgage.
Yes. No, I agree.
And like, there's this whole aspect of it. It's like, okay, we're going to delay your mortgage for 3 months, but 3 months that later, you're going to have to pay all of it back at once. But if you're not working these past 3 months, how do you pay your mortgage? How do you pay your bills?
Yeah, there are flaws.
Yeah. And there are so many people. And I understand, like, you know, people who are driven through that background. I can see how, even though how this might have then concluded to something unreasonable, like, oh, my freedom. I mean, people don't really know how to express their emotions very well. But unfortunately, there is a whole variety of people who are affected. And it sucks how, you know, we as a general public, we may not feel as Americans that we're being fully taken care of.
Yes. Right?
And unfortunately, that leads to uproar and differences.
But this uproar and this difference is like they're not. I understand being upset that the economy is crashing, but the economy will inevitably bounce back. And this is something you and I have talked about. But if we have so many deaths and we don't have healthcare personnel to be able to take care of us, like that's worse than money. And I know that like getting evicted and all of that sucks, and that should be addressed separately, kind of like New York is not allowing evictions right now, should be addressed separately. But this isn't, you shouldn't be out there protesting and therefore spreading the virus more.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, like, yeah. I can understand the frustration and the feeling of despair because you're not making money and because you still have bills to pay and you have, it's a scary time.
I don't want to completely disregard these people's emotions. I disagree with their actions. I don't think what they're doing is right.
Yeah.
But this doesn't mean that they're not having a hard time. And that's the important part that I feel as when we're dealing with such important emotionally driven things is because now if we just target them as people, oh, you're just complaining, you're just being completely unreasonable, we take away the human factor of the fact that they're suffering.
Right? Yes.
And that's the only thing that I want to make a note of this, right? Again, I completely disagree with the fact that what they're doing is wrong and how they're responding to their troubles is wrong.
I think what I also disagree with and what I can't acknowledge, I can acknowledge the feelings of despair. I can acknowledge the fact that like you have bills to pay and you can't work and that is stressful and like you might have a family to support completely. But what I can't support and I can't get behind and I can't even try to understand is the spread of false information saying that we're accounting for more deaths and this and that when we're not. Like a death certificate is a legal document. You know, you can't falsify that. They're not counting any death as a COVID. Like information like that. That's what I can't get behind, and that's part of what they're
There's always going to be conspiracy theorists,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and that just drives me crazy. Like, you've got people out there risking their lives every day, doing the research, doing the work, giving you solid information, and people...
And instead, you read an article online instead of the actual research
or
data.
Or you just read an article somebody posted on Facebook or somebody's Facebook opinion. Mm-hmm. So that's my sarcoma of the week, if not the month.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, that theme will probably continue, hopefully for not too much longer. Okay, so I guess that'll kind of conclude, unfortunately, again, through a poor tone. It is a pretty somber atmosphere for the last month or so. But I'll conclude this episode's podcast. You know, thanks so much, Dr. Colaretta, for joining me on this podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, hopefully you'll come back soon or come back again. I am planning on having, you know, more interviews. Let me know if anyone's interested in kind of the little monologues that I've been having prior to the interviews. These tend to be just, you know, it's more fun to bounce back ideas when you talk to somebody, especially someone you love. But I appreciate everyone listening in. Please stay safe. I hope, you know, those who are affected personally with family members, you have my dearest sincerities. I really hope that everyone gets through this soon, and stay safe.
All right. Bye.
Take care.